You're listening to the Unsiloed Podcast with Greg LeBlanc, brought to you by Alumni.fm. Unsiloed is a series of interdisciplinary conversations that inspire new ways of thinking about our world. So wherever you are today, enjoy today's episode, and here's your host, Greg LeBlanc.
Welcome to Unsiloed. This is Greg LeBlanc, and I'm here with Alex Bezarides, who is at Lewis Clark State College, and he is the author of Evolution Gone Wrong: The Curious Reasons Why Our Bodies Work or Don't. Alex, I have to say this was probably, I'll say almost certainly this was the funniest book about evolutionary biology that I've ever read. I've read quite a few books.
That was one of my goals. Consider that box checked.
and I've read plenty of books, and there's definitely some ground that I've encountered elsewhere. But you have this unifying narrative, right, which is that evolution does a pretty good job, but it's not perfect. And I remember I used to teach this class on economics and biology, and the first book that I had everybody read was this one called Optima for Animals. I don't know if you remember this book, but it was really cool because what it tried to illustrate was that every design feature in organisms was a product of trade-offs, right? So you have to trade off strength versus weight, and evolution somehow magically always got the right answer, right? It always understood all these trade-offs. So kind of as if it was designing from scratch like an engineer. And I think what you point out is that, well, there's this path dependence and that, you know, you can't get from A to B necessarily, because you can't really skip steps, and that evolution requires you to move through a series of adjacent steps. And that often leads to some interesting design features or maybe design bugs. And then there's another theme, I think, that runs through the book, which is that we're designed for an environment. And then there's maybe, the environment in which we find ourselves might be missing some key functionality, which we might have gotten from our environment in the past, which we're unfortunately not getting now. And so while some of these features may be unavoidable, the bugs, there may be some ways that we can kind of mitigate the worst effects of the bugs. All right, I hope that's a fair summary of your narrative.
Yeah, I think that's a very good summation of the thesis. I think ultimately the pros have to outweigh the cons, or the animal doesn't survive and reproduce and go on. And I felt like there were a fair amount of books written out there about sort of the elegance and beauty of evolution and all the amazing things that it set up the human body for. And that's all certainly true. I mean, it's led us down this path that is unlike any other animal and allows us to control our environment in ways no other animal can. But there's the other side of the coin, right? There's always those trade-offs that come along. And sometimes you don't even realize that those trade-offs are maybe something that has been made until the environment changes, or until something happens that puts you in a position where all of a sudden, you know, you're not in as strong a spot as you thought you were. And to me, those are the interesting stories of evolution. And once I started looking for them in the body, I kind of got turned on to the idea of I started down this path of why our teeth don't fit in our mouths. And the more I read about it, the more I learned that it has all these fantastic aspects that are outside of biology, all these cultural and social pieces about the control of fire and tool use and all these really wild things. I started reading this book called, I think it's called Fork. It's on my shelf somewhere. That was just all about the history of cutlery and how humans have handled their food. Mm-hmm. And I thought, man, and I realized the answer to that question is so complex, but also so fascinating that I thought that I want to start writing about this. And then after I'd kind of got some things down on paper there, I started to look for other places in the body that don't work quite as well as you might expect. And they just started sort of rolling from one system to the next. As I would be teaching in a semester of anatomy and physiology, we'd get to the digestive system and we'd find something there that was totally clunky that we didn't usually talk about. And I'd work on that. And slowly but surely, I put together kind of enough material to have something.
Well, you mentioned that you teach anatomy and physiology. And this is, I've been in university my entire life and I've never actually taken a course on this. And you mentioned early in the book that this is a subject that is taught pretty much at every university, at every college, but it's usually taught in a very, you know, this is how it works, boom, end of story, full stop. And maybe you do some dissection and you kind of see how things fit together. But the whole idea of, you know, evolutionary theory, or kind of thinking through the whys or the wherefores, this has not historically been a part of this course. And I think you try to bring it into the course. So first of all, is it possible for people to study this and not immediately wonder, you know, why? And is that whole conversation just said, well, don't worry about it, that's just a distraction? Or why has this not been part of the curriculum?
Right. I think the answer to that is because people try and cover too much content. I think they try and get, you know, they try and ram every single possible feature of anatomy and physiology down the kids' throats in a semester or two, depending on what the kind of class. And I sort of more take the approach, yes, there are some things they have to come out of their knowing. You know, there's going to be a downstream class. Like here, a lot of the pre-nursing students have to take this downstream class in pathophysiology. And so I talk to the people that teach that and make sure that they have down, you know, the pathways and the physiology they need for that class. But then I've always kind of viewed the job as beyond getting those absolute basic things in the toolbox that they have to have, they just need to learn how to learn, and they need to learn how to figure things out and do it on their own, because that's what they're going to be doing for the rest of their lives after this short, brief blip of school. And so in that sense, I feel like every year I teach, I pull back a little more on the content, and we talk a little bit more about theory, and we build in things like evolution, I try to give them a little more global perspective. So they go away and there's a couple muscles in the forearm that might've gotten triaged. I'm okay with that if they are able to sort of think more critically and bigger picture. And so I think that's the book is ridiculous, right? The book has, I tell them, as textbooks have gotten so crazy expensive, I've taken the policy in my class. It says in my syllabus, I would like you to have an anatomy and physiology text that is at least 1,000 pages long and was written this millennium. And then we go online the first day and I show them, like, here's a good one. It's $4. So they can get a book for very cheap, but that book is, they're 1,200 pages and they're incredibly dense. And I really view my job as going through that thing and figuring out, what do they need to know right now? And what can we sort of table for them to learn later if they go into some specialty field by which they actually, you know, need to pick up these other details. So taking that approach has freed up a little bit of time in my classes to explore some issues that maybe aren't explored necessarily in other A and P classes.
What's kind of puzzling though is even when people go down that road and they become specialists, rather if they become a dentist or a podiatrist or an optometrist, and you point out that, you know, to become any of those things requires years and years of training, and they may understand the mechanics pretty well, but it's astonishing to me how ignorant they are when it comes to the why questions, right? So typically if you go to a dentist and say, well, why are my teeth crooked? Well, you know, it's genetic. Or if you go to an eye doctor and you go, it's genetic. And I feel like this is just sort of a, who cares, a dismissal? Or is there a reason why they're not interested? Because it would seem to me that, like, if we really understood the whys, we may be able to reduce the prevalence of some of the disorders that they have to remediate.
You're right. And it takes a special care provider to kind of go there. I think for most of them, there's just not enough hours in the day for them to just stay on top of the day-to-day of their job. I think take so much time that they can't put the time into the other piece of it. And like it's my wife's cousin. She just graduated with a medical degree and she started on the medical path. She's a general surgeon in the upper Midwest. And I had a short conversation with her over one of the holidays. It was like by the time she had finished medical school and practiced for about a year, immediately they were transitioning all these different surgeries that she would do, you know, appendix, gallbladder, all these different things. It was all becoming laparoscopic and robot driven. And she had just finished as intensive a training as you can have. And already they were immediately pivoting her to a completely different way of doing surgery. And it'll be like that, I would suspect, for her whole career. And as a consequence, there's probably just not enough hours in the day to throw the why at it. Another example that comes to mind, we read a great book in my classes a few years ago called Dr. Q. It's about this, it's this incredible story of this physician that he migrates to this country from Mexico and ends up in the States and has this incredible pull up from your bootstraps kind of story where he works the fields in California and then he ends up being the chief of surgery at Johns Hopkins. I mean, it's just an unbelievable story. And he goes, his career path as a physician is to study and do surgery on these people that have these neural glioblastomas, these brain cancers that just get into their brain like a spider web and create this cancerous tissue that's just almost just impossible to cut out. And so for the early part of his career, he worked as a surgeon removing these tumors from people's brains, and it would buy them a little bit of time. But ultimately, you can't take out a whole spider web of cancerous tissue in a brain, and it would come back, and the people would, they'd eventually die, you know, relatively shortly thereafter. And so he kind of made a mid-career pivot where he just said, I've got to look at the why question. I've got to start looking at this from the perspective of why does this happen instead of trying to treat it afterwards. And so he started doing research on it instead. And that's what I think we need more people doing, is exploring that aspect of it, rather than, we have to have people that can do the surgery, do the treatment down the end, but you also need people working on the why, because you're absolutely right. Without that, none of these things ever get solved. We just put Band-Aids on them for the rest of all time.
Well, in the first chapters where you talk about the teeth and eyes, you know, and you walk through kind of the origin of the relatively recent origin of both the shape of our face, and perhaps not quite so recent, but the movement from the sea to the land and how that impacts our eyes. But I think there seems to be some evidence that the mess that our teeth have become and the impairment of our vision is something that's even more recent, right? That it's not something that there are some ancestors, you know, our 10,000 year ago ancestors might not have had these problems, right? Is it fair to say that these problems have been getting worse with not just becoming humans, but also with modernity?
I think there's no question they're getting worse. I sort of view it as a doubling down on the issue. I'd like to describe it as, I think because of our evolutionary past, we have this likelihood, this propensity to develop issues with our jaw and our teeth and the mismatch there, or with our vision. And then the modern behaviors then really push it over the edge. And in the case of the eyes, you know, it's likely this trapping ourselves inside all the time as children. The eyes just don't develop to the right length. But certainly the eye has inherent fallibility because it evolved in the water initially. And that makes it will always be a bit of a jury-rigged structure as a result. But we definitely make things worse with some of our modern behaviors with our jaws. You know, kids just don't chew enough, and that the jaw just doesn't even have a chance to develop to the size and strength that it needs to be to fit these giant teeth in it. And then pretty quickly we just give up and pull the teeth out or slap braces on them and, you know, try and fix it with our modern conveniences.
Right. I recently had some surgery done on a tooth that had fractured and I'd gotten it infected. And this very likely would have killed me if we didn't have kind of modern antibiotics and that sort of thing. But, you know, I probably would not have had the fractured tooth potentially if my teeth were not and jaw were not so poorly formed, right?
Right.
By my upbringing. So modernity giveth and modernity taketh away, right?
I think all the time about, I've never read any data about sort of what percentage of us, you know, on average would have been knocked off before 40 or 50 years old without sort of modern intervention. I mean, I'd have been in a real pickle. I had my appendix out at 18 years old. And if you needed your appendix out 10,000 years ago, that was a tricky one. You know, I mean, you'd have been gritting your teeth for somebody to cut that thing out. And if you don't get it out, the likelihood of surviving a ruptured appendix, that's, talk about a bacterial infection run amok.
Well, I saw a picture recently of a guy who was a Russian doctor in Antarctica who had to remove his own appendix, which
stuck down there without help.
Seemed like a little bit of he was the only doctor, I think. So he had to kind of do it with a mirror. But I'm surprised you actually didn't write a chapter on the appendix, because that's another example of what appears to be a bug, but, you know, is really probably a feature in our ancestral environment, maybe even in large parts of the contemporary environment outside of where we have clean water and so forth, right?
For sure. I have a few folders of like other chapters that I was considering. You know, you're restricted on length. They tell you this many words. But the ones that didn't make the cut, the appendix didn't make the cut, largely because I felt like that ground had been quite well covered. And then the other piece of that is that there's some really modern stuff that's come out that suggests, you know, that the appendix has a sort of more of a significant positive role than people realize. It's got this new hypothesis of it being sort of a panic room for your body where it can store bacteria in case you have a real bacterial blowout upset kind of moment. It needs to repopulate your gut with the positive flora. So there are some neat ideas that I thought that had been pretty well covered. The other one that didn't make the cut that has all kinds of interesting biology behind it are sinuses. The evolution of human sinuses is a wild story. We end up with all these crazy pockets that infection and can fill up with stuff in your head. And there's all these amazing hypotheses about why we have all these holes in our skulls. So that's another one someday I'd like to get into, but just didn't make it into this one.
Yeah. Well, a big chunk of your book is really about the aches and pains associated with bipedalism, right? And part of the story is, why the heck did we become bipedal if it comes with so much baggage? And we've heard there's lots of stories out there. The one that I found novel, which I'd never seen before, is this kind of the waiting ape hypothesis. So I was wondering if you could kind of, you know, articulate that and how you, I mean, I loved how you actually decided to validate the hypothesis personally with some experiments of your own.
Right. I think about that transitional period a lot. And the two things that always come to mind for me that I stress to my students are that when that happened for hominids, and we're going from hominids to hominins at that point, which is sort of this new vocabulary that the paleoanthropologists use, hominins being sort of after that transition to bipedalism, that's the word used for our ancestors at that point. I stress to my students that when they're thinking about that, they have to understand that was not something that would have been done by choice. It would have been something that had to happen because the food availability or the shelter availability, whatever it was, changed. I mean, if everything's going great, the animal's not gonna leave where they are if they're warm enough and their bellies are full and nothing's threatening them. So something happened, and it was probably climate change that changed food availability. So that drives the animals out of the trees and down to the ground. But then on the ground, it's important to realize that's a monumental, huge shift in the way that you get around. And it's not something that can happen overnight. So how did the transition take place? And this waiting, so the idea of this waiting hypothesis is that at the time there were, and there's good evidence for this, that there were parts of Africa that were flooded and had these sort of low floodplains. And the idea is that sort of if you're up on 2 feet and you're on land and you're right at the moment of that transition, it's a very awkward thing for the body. There's nothing to support the weight of the body. It's tough on the back. It's tough on your knees. It's really physically difficult. And I stress that in the book, like if you just sort of go into a crouched stance, which is what it would have had to have been. You know, it wasn't until later that the legs could lock. If you just do that on land, it's terribly uncomfortable. But if you get in a little bit of water, kind of hip deep or chest deep water, all of a sudden you can stand on 2 feet all day long, and the water supports the weight of the body. So that's this kind of new idea out there about how the transition might have taken place. Not that we were fully aquatic and swimming around. That's sort of this older idea that's been shelved, but the wading might have been an important part of it. And I think it's one of the more compelling ideas I've heard for at least how the transition could have taken place. So it'll be interesting to see now that idea is kind of on the table, but if there's evidence, you know, in the next generation of researchers to support it.
Right. And so why is that we need to have sort of the transition? You know, why, you know, we have one equilibrium where we're in the trees, we have another equilibrium where we're, you know, out in the savanna, and right, the body seems to be optimized for those different formats, but they're so radically different, yeah, presumably, that you need to have some kind of transition path, right? That would make sense.
Yeah. And it's a couple million years. I mean, it's quite a while until you end up with the skeletal modifications switching you from hominid to hominin that make it so that you don't really have to be supported anymore. And, you know, you get curves in the back, and the shape of the angle of the femurs changes, and all these things happen over a million, you know, a couple million years in that period, sort of between 4 or 5 million years ago and 2 million years ago. And then by then you're kind of off and running. Now you're talking about transitioning to the members of our genus Homo. And now you have an animal that, instead of just kind of probably uncomfortably walking around, can start to run and really can start to take full advantage of the bipedal life, right? Because there's huge advantage. You got these things free all of a sudden, right? So now there's all kinds of behaviors you can engage in throwing and carrying that just aren't part of the quadrupedal life.
Right. And as a result of this, you know, we have, as part of the trade-off, as part of the price we pay for this, we have back pain, right? We have foot pain. You know, you talk about how most of the bones, half of the human bones are in our hands and in our feet. And it makes sense for our hands, right? Because of what we're trying to do with them. But it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense for our feet.
It used to make sense for our feet, right? When they needed to be nimble and grabbing branches and doing all these things. But now they're just a mess. You got all these bones down there that are just pounding the earth, which is not what they were sort of made to do. And they slip and slide and sprain and do all these So I go into one of my favorite sort of researchers that I lean on a lot in this book is Jeremy De Silva. He's this great, he is the foot and ankle paleoanthropologist at this moment. And he's written all this great work about how, you know, if you were going to design a human foot, this would be the most idiotic design ever. You would not make it with all these parts that could slip around for something that just needs to basically pound the earth. And you see that in animals that have been on the ground for a much, much, much longer time as bipeds, things like birds. They've kind of got it all just into a few bones that are banging against the earth rather than, you know, literally dozens of bones that can slip and slide out of place. So like we started off with, right? Pros and cons. I mean, there's incredible things about being up on 2 feet and having the freedom to use your hands, but it comes at a cost. And for a lot of people, that cost is sore feet.
Well, and you mentioned that when we're designing artificial feet, right? So when we design artificial hands, they kind of look a lot like actual hands. But when we design artificial feet, they don't look at all like feet. If you look at the Olympic runners, right, with those big, you know, pendulum things, right, they don't look at all like, they have like one part.
That's right. And nothing to slip and slide out of the way. Yeah. And that's exactly what you sort of, more like the model you see. And ostriches always come up because ostriches just pound the earth constantly with their feet. And they've been at it for 100 million years rather than 5 million years, you know. And that's a long time to work out the kinks. And if we were still being forced to run several miles a day to forage and gather our food and do the, you know, I think given 100 million years, a lot of these kinks would probably work themselves out. Now that we just click a button or drive to the store, it's probably not. I think we're probably stuck with sore knees and sore feet.
But that is our superpower, right? That we can go for super long distances and pursue these animals. So is there any evidence among hunter-gatherers that they have, you know, the same kind of foot troubles that we have? Or is our foot troubles due in part to our footwear and kind of our, you mentioned sort of squatting in the book a bit, but I've heard that squatting actually reduces the probability that you're going to have injuries because you know, stretch the hamstring and so forth.
Right.
And, or is it just that hunter-gatherers, you know, they usually stop doing this by the time they're 40. And so they're not running into the same problems that we run into.
Yeah. I think there is some evidence that the way that they run and the way they grow up, and especially if they're barefoot all the time, you know, that can lead to a healthier foot. It's kind of what has born this barefoot revolution in running. And a lot of data is being collected right now to support it. I'm trying to write some questions that profs and teachers can use in their classes with the book. And one of the things I'm doing is finding some new papers with some more modern research. And I just found this fascinating article a couple of weeks ago that I'm incorporating into the questions for the foot chapter, where they took kids from a school in South Africa, where the kids had grown up barefoot their whole lives, and a school in Germany, same age kids, matching them as well as they for kids that had grown up and, you know, shod their whole lives. And then they put them through this battery of tests. We're going to test you for balance. We're going to test your jumping. We're going to test your sprinting. And it was fascinating. Like, the kids that had grown up barefoot were better at certain tasks. They were better. They had much better balance. You know, they'd run them on a balance beam. And the kids that had been barefoot their whole lives had much better balance. But the kids that had been shod were better in other things. They were a little bit faster. They were, you know, a little bit. So it was sort of, there was like this trade-off. And it depends on what skill you're looking for, you know. But the sort of conclusion of the paper was that ultimately some balance is probably good. The kids that are in shoes all the time need to be barefoot a little bit more growing up. It develops the strength of their foot in a different way and their balance in a different way. But I think we're just at the start of that conversation in terms of which of those is best. And I suspect, I'm one of those biologists that believes the answer is almost always in the middle. I suspect the answer will be that both parties could benefit a little bit from the other behavior.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if they continue this longitudinally to sort of look and see if there's any pathologies that develop differentially across these different groups, right?
As a scientist, one of the things I ask as in these questions, I say, are there anything about this study that you would change or that you felt that could be done better? I mean, ultimately, that experiment needs to be done with randomly divided kids from the same environment. And we get to them early, and you could do this in parts of, I mean, they could take that South African group and be like, all right, now this school, we're going to, these are as close.
If you get shoes, right?
Yeah, we're going to give this school shoes and this school not, and we're going to follow those kids for 30 years and see what happens. That's what you really need to get at the answer and go in every year or two and test them for the different kind of things they did, balance and speed. And that would be fantastic, but logistically a, you know, nightmare.
Well, I mean, you could do, I mean, you know, we've done some of those longitudinal studies on things like diet, right? And so forth. I mean, presumably we could do that. We could maybe take kids and put them in outdoor classrooms and see if their, you know, vision is better. Yeah. We could take some kids and give their parents, you know, beef jerky or whatever, and then say, here's some free beef jerky. Let's see what happens. And
then
track them. We probably wouldn't have to track them that long. We could probably track them until they were, you know, teenagers. And see if there's...
With teeth, you'd have everything you needed by the time they were 13, 15 years old. With some of the other things, you might have to go a little bit longer, but you're right. As long as you're careful and don't let your shoe study be funded by Nike, you should be good.
Well, but even if it was funded by Nike, they could offer multiple types of shoes, some of which were more informed by, you know, the plantigrade approach to walking and the other one, the other approaches, right?
Right. I just will insist that my researchers at the end of the thing are blinded at the end of it.
That'd be tough to know, you know, conceal what kind of shoe you're wearing.
No, I just mean when we bring in the physician for the assessment, they do not know whether the kid was shod or barefoot.
Well, it'd probably be visible, right? Because your foot would be considerably wider, right?
It'd be interesting to know if the arch, you know, how does the development of the arch change for, you know, being in shoes versus not. I've started to look at kids' feet. One thing I didn't realize until I was doing all the reading for this book was I didn't realize we didn't come out with arches. Like, I didn't know that we all come out flat footed and that arches. So right as I was writing that chapter, my daughter was right in that age when the arches starting to develop in her foot. And so I was kind of looking at that with a whole fresh set of eyes, all these things that you've never noticed your whole life, that kids just have flat feet and it doesn't kick in till they're 5, 6 years old.
Yeah. When I noticed when I started doing yoga and I was trying to stand on one foot and I realized, well, my foot's so narrow that it's kind of hard. And you look at some of these people that have been doing this for years and you notice that their feet are capable of so much more, you know, breadth because they spend less time in shoes.
Yeah. That inspires me to spend less time in shoes because I have these feet where my toes just overlap like that, but they're just cramped together and I just can't even begin to, I can maybe do that for about 2 seconds, but then they immediately snap back. And I think it's ultimately, I like to think it's not too late, but it's going to take some training at this point to get those things to spread back out to their natural width.
Well, now what about the back pain? Because that's another one. And apparently, I think in the book, you mentioned that this is, you know, among the top ailments that people complain of in developed economies. It's, you know, way up there at the top of the list. Now, I think there's some people that are doubtful that they think this pain is something else and it could be treated with phantom surgery and placebos and stuff. But there is some design flaws in the back. And you talk a bit about, a lot of people think it's just due to sitting, and sitting is the new smoking and you know, the modern lack of exercise and so forth. But you argue that it's the modern lack of exercise and so forth, but it's got design problems.
Yeah, I do think it's inevitable. I think the only question is it's a when, not an if. Are you lucky enough that it holds off till you're 55, 60, 70, or if you're unlucky, it kicks in, you know, in your 30s or even earlier. And it's all those curves. I mean, the other hominids, the chimps and gorillas, they all have a C-shaped spine and it kind of forces them forward. It's why they don't like to walk on 2 feet. They can do it, but they kind of want to topple forward because of their C-shaped spines. So to pop an animal like that up on 2 feet was going to require some curves into the spine. So there's these natural curves that built over that transitional time into the human spine. And those curves are delicate and they have to be maintained, or you get discs slipping out of place and pushing on a neural tissue. And as soon as that happens, incredible pain ensues. And the take home message for me about the spine, and I really came at this from talking to a lot of different people that had just been wrecked by their back, was it was all core strength. If you kept your core really strong, then the muscles, because it's the muscles of the back and your abdomen and your obliques, all those muscles work to maintain the shape of those curves. And as soon as those muscles weaken, then those curves start to sort of slide out of place, and that's when it all falls apart. And so we do have some control over that. If you keep that core nice and strong, the kicker is that everybody's only one little slip away, you know, in an acute event from sort of something unlucky happening that that can cause it to derail also. So there's a lot of luck involved in that also.
So sitting in front of a computer all day probably isn't the best thing for your back.
It's certainly not the best thing. I think but standing in front of a computer all day is also not good for your back, and probably then going to hurt your feet also. I think ultimately the answer is you just got to mix it up. You spend some of the day just be walking around moving as much as you can and transitioning from one thing to another. And I mean, it's tough when you have to sit it happens to me. I get to writing, I get to do stuff, I get down the rabbit hole and 2-3 hours go by and I have barely moved a lick. And you have to try and force yourself out of that and just hop up and, you know, go do 20 pushups and take a break and then come back.
Right. So standing on your feet all day teaching is also not a great thing for your back.
That's exactly right. And it's also, that one's also tough on my feet. As I've gotten older, I've had to develop strategies for those 6-hour lab days where I just go back to back. Today wasn't one of those days, actually. Or at the end of the day, my feet are just absolutely barking at me.
Now, in your discussion about the knee, you know, there's great discussion about the built-in flaws that we've got to deal with. But what I found most interesting in that segment was your discussion of these kind of atavistic traits, or these traits where, you know, it reminded me, I think there was this movie that came out in the 70s, right? And I can't remember what it was, Altered States, right? And they had this, I don't know if you remember this movie, but it was sort of expressing the idea that all of the information that was used to create all of our ancestors, we just, in other words, we have like an append, it's almost like an append-only database.
Right,
we just keep adding stuff and we don't actually delete a lot of stuff, right?
I hadn't really ever thought of the genome in that way. And then I had this student that had this wild experience with her knee, where she just had all these tons of knee surgeries by her early 20s. And so I started reading about her condition, this condition. She had a discoid medial meniscus, and I came to realize that it's more common. So the meniscus is usually sort of this crescent-shaped, the lateral meniscus is usually this kind of crescent-shaped tissue. And I came to learn that there are a certain percentage of the population that have this meniscus that should be shaped one way, and instead it's shaped like a disc. And it turns out that it's a reversion to the ancestral state. And as I read about it more and more, I came to realize that, like the genome, when things change and genes duplicate and genes evolve, a lot of the old information is still in there. It's kind of turned off, it's downregulated, and it's not necessarily used, but it's still sitting there. Just like a crotch,
like a tail, like you could be born with a tail.
Exactly. Like, so and we see, you can see a lot of this embryologically and developmentally. Well, traits will sort of start, and they have to head down a pathway, and all humans sort of go through a process where they might have, you know, where they do have. Everybody's got a little bit of a tail embryologically as they develop, and then in most humans, those genes turn off and go away, and the whole thing regresses, and you're born without a tail. But not in everybody. And every now and again, somebody's born with a tail because it's still in there. It's still part of the book, if you will. And there are a few of these kinds of traits around the body. So, you know, there are some that don't really cause, that aren't that big a deal, like an extra nipple or something like that, that are way more common than I realized. It's like a couple percent of people that have it's called a supernumerary nipple. And it's this atavistic trait that's written into our DNA from when we descended from animals that had far more nipples than we have now. And then you get into ones that can actually cause problems, like when the meniscus comes out shaped one way that really worked better in a quadruped than it does in a biped. And that causes those knees to shift and slip and blow out and tear ligaments. And then once you kind of start down that path of a troubled knee, it really seems like it just snowballs. And all of a sudden the cartilage, once you get damage to the ligaments, the cartilage got to do more work. And then the cartilage starts to wear down, and the cartilage, we can't really even do anything for you if the cartilage starts to wear out. There's still yet, I mean, it's you know, even in the 21st century, there's not a lot that modern medicine can do for you when some of that padding wears out, you know, other than a total knee replacement, which is going to change the way your knee works forever. So yeah, these atavistic traits, that's one of those topics that I had to leave it behind and move on, or I was going to spend 20 years writing the book. But I'd like to, now that it's done, go back and learn about other ones, because I bet there are other interesting atavisms in the body that I don't even know about.
So that student of yours presumably would have been really good at the four-legged race Olympics, right? If we had such a thing, right?
Yeah, her knee was set up to have her do the four-legged 100-meter dash. That's right.
I think that might be a candidate for the next Olympics. We could probably try to smuggle that in.
Oh man, people haven't. I tell people the link in the book. If you haven't gotten seen, watch the video of the guy that is the world record holder in the 4-legged 100-meter dash. It's just wild to watch. I mean, he runs it in 15 seconds flat, and it's kind of incredible to see that even though we have this body that's now 5 million years removed from being a quadruped, there's still enough quadrupedal DNA in there that you can scamper down the track pretty quickly if you're motivated.
Well, now, another fun fact that I learned only from this book is that the babies can both breathe and swallow at the same time, right? So their larynx is way up in their throat, and you can even see it sometimes when you look in their mouths when they're very young, and only later does it descend. And that's one reason why even if they knew how to speak, they probably couldn't speak, right?
Yeah, that's right, because they don't have the space above the larynx necessary to kind of form the words into something other than sort of oh and ah, and they can't make a lot of those sounds that are an integral part of human speech until the larynx starts to descend. But then, of course, once it does descend, the beauty of an infant in terms of their larynx is that it's sitting high up in their throat, and it gives them this just perfect separation of those two pathways, of their pathway for air and their pathway for food. So like you said, they're a nurse. They don't even have to come off the nipple. And as long as their nose isn't all stuffed up, which it sometimes is, but as long as their nose isn't stuffed up, they can breathe the whole time while they're nursing. As soon as that larynx descends, now all of a sudden those pathways have to cross. The pathway for air and the pathway for food have to cross. And now you have a setup that makes you prone to choking. And kids are especially prone to choking because the opening is about that big for their trachea. And if anything goes down the wrong pipe, it's likely to get stuck. And they're not really out of the woods. I mean, I was hacking up my daughter's grapes and hot dogs until very recently. She's about to turn 9, and I was cutting those things up into teeny little bits until very recently, when I feel like she's just now starting to kind of come out of the years where you have to really worry about it a lot. And then we all get back into it when we're older and the muscles weaken that kind of help keep the separation and everything intact.
Yeah, the one thing I learned also is that you mentioned like there's an entire journal on swallowing. There's an entire journal on the meniscus, right? There's like an academic journal for every single body part, it seems, and every single bodily function.
Yeah, and a book on them. I mean, the meniscus one killed me. I was digging into that and really trying to figure out and understand, and I kept coming back to this one reference, and I would look at it, and I would be sure it would just be a journal article or something. And it wasn't. And it's a 435-page book on the meniscus. It's just the devil of detail out there is unbelievable.
Well, I'm glad you read it so I don't have to.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. But I think that the lesson of the throat and the windpipe is one that really does make your point very strongly, right? You know, when we think about rivers changing their course, right? You know, the Mississippi River has a big oxbow in it. And then, you know, one day it just starts going in another direction. That's not how evolution works, right? So evolution would never have come up with the Fosbury flop, right? It would have just kept trying to do the scissor jump higher and higher and higher and more efficiently, but it would never, you know, there would never be this discontinuous flip, like pushing your lungs to the back of putting them behind your stomach and so forth, right? Like that's never going to happen.
Right. I mean, the people that were doing the scissor kick just would have all probably just died at some point, and some other thing that did it, that came and jumped over the bar completely differently would have been the one that went on to survive, you know.
But it probably wouldn't have been the same species, right? So it wouldn't have been
likely something different, which is I think why when you get these giant, I mean, why I love to talk about the giant climactic, like when, you know, these extinction events, the Permian Triassic extinction event and the Cretaceous, the KT boundary in my classes, where the Permian Triassic extinction event, the one that was 250 million years ago, 96% of known organisms wiped from the face of the earth, you know? So the environment changes in some dramatic way. And yeah, most animals just were not able in that moment to pivot in a way that allowed them to get through that. And a few did, of course. And then those go on to diverge and radiate and repopulate the earth until the next incredible extinction event. But yeah, you're absolutely right. When those things come along, it tends to wipe out a lot of the animals.
One of the side effects of our throat organization is snoring and sleep apnea. And you talk about this. One thing I read was that the muscles of the larynx and can be strengthened through through song or through
interesting,
you know, wind instruments.
And, yeah, and that's so, an interesting study to be done, like looking at rates of sleep apnea and, you know, in orchestral players versus their spouses. And that'd be fascinating to see whether or not you can really train those muscles to stay strong in such a way that it helps keep your windpipe open mm-hmm. during sleep.
Because, I mean, the role of song in our culture has been sort of diminishing sort of monotonically for the last 1,000 years, right? And so, I mean, is there any evidence that sleep apnea and snoring is also sort of a more of a modern phenomenon than it would have been in say, our ancestors?
Really interesting question. That's not one I've ever read about. And, you know, whether or not those muscles have weakened over time is not something about. Everything I've read suggested that as long as we've sort of had a lowered larynx, which is not as, you know, that happened a little more recently than most people realize. It's a tough thing to study in because those are all soft tissues and none of it fossilizes all that well. So you have to study the structures of the neck, the vertebrae in the neck and the shape of the skull. But what I've read is that the number that I kind of have in my head from all, everything I read was that somewhere around 50,000 years ago is when sort of the modern head and neck comes into place. That means for most of the time humans have been humans, they weren't capable of the type of speech that they are now. But the other things about snoring and sleep apnea suggest that when that happened, that probably sort of entered the human lineage. Now it'd be fascinating to sort of tackle this idea whether or not, you know, people that incorporate more of an exercise or a pastime, something musical, something song related, having the opportunity to keep those muscles intact in such a way that maybe they don't go down a sleep apnea or snoring path. That's a really cool idea.
Well, you've spent a lot of time also on the book about reproduction and pregnancy and giving birth. And this, I think this is probably the mother of all trade-offs, right? You know, and it's been written about extensively, but what I didn't know about was the kind of the ham and egg stuff that you mentioned. Right. So could you talk about that? I mean, it seems like the trade-off that we all know is that humans need big brains. Humans are also bipedal. So those two together are a bad combination, right?
Yeah. The question, it all starts with a question, right? And the question that sort of drives that hypothesis is looking at answering is why are human babies born so much earlier than it seems like they should be? You know, why do they come out so completely and totally and utterly helpless? And they really do compared to so many other species. I mean, ours just come out, and even other altricial animals like a rat or a wolf or something, yeah, you know, their eyes are closed and they're a little, but pretty quickly they're kind of up and at them compared to a human. And of course, some precocial animals, see, you need a whole other trimester really to keep the thing in there and get it up to the point where it could be a little more, you know, independent at birth. And it impacts our lives in such an enormous way, because that child requires all this tremendous amount of care. So why not just leave it inside a little longer? So the hypothesis that dominated the discussion forever was this idea of the obstetric dilemma, that so because we're up on 2 feet and the shape of the hips change and they've got the kids have these giant brains that basically if the woman's body, if it was going to keep that kid in there any longer, she wouldn't even be able to walk because the shape of the hips would have to change and such, you know, would have to be so different. And it's an easy idea to kind of wrap your head around that there's this trade-off between bipedalism and birth. And so that idea kind of dominated the discussion. Well, then once people started collecting evidence for that idea, sort of actually measuring pelvic width in current women and all the way back in the fossil record, it turns out the evidence isn't great to support the idea. In fact, our hips, a woman's hips could even sort of spread a little bit wider than they do currently, and still she'd still be okay biomechanically and able to run around. And there's not even quite the gender differences aren't quite as significant as people thought. So this woman, Holly Dunsworth, has sort of thrown this new idea on the table that it's really more driven by metabolism and energetics, that the kid reaches a point, again, because of the ridiculous brain that humans try to grow, that you reach a point where the child cannot be supported metabolically anymore on the inside, that it has to be born to be able to provide for it energetically, that you reach a point where the woman just can't provide for it more metabolically.
So it requires more metabolism on the inside than on the outside.
Yeah, and you reach a point where it has to be birthed for that reason. And it just so happens that in humans, that happens before the brain is fully developed because we're trying to grow such a ridiculously large brain. So we end up with these brains that are relative to other animals that are born. Ours are underdeveloped. They're still big because we have big brains, but they're not as big relative to where they're going to get. And so you end up with a kid that is, they just come out and they're just not sort of ready for this world. And so it's another one of these cases where you sort of have an older idea, and now there's a new idea coming in, and we'll see. The evidence, I think, is starting to fall down in favor of this sort of energetics of gestation and growth, I think is what she calls it, hypothesis. But it's a fascinating new idea in that field that attempts to explain that aspect of. There's so many other pieces of it. That's just one piece of it, is, you know, why kids have to come out early.
Well, we're certainly seeing a rise in the number of cesareans, right? And, you know, I don't know how quickly people can evolve, right? I mean, certainly we've seen examples of people evolving faster when it comes to kind of lactose tolerance and so forth. And some people have speculated that if we just move entirely to kind of cesarean birth, then women's hips can get even smaller. Right?
Go in a totally different direction. Yeah, the rate of cesarean sections has gone up. I think birth has sort of hit the points, the one spot for me where you're finally sort of being checked by natural selection, because you have these brains that, you know, the brain got bigger as humans. First, you have the bipedal issue, which did change the shape of the birth canal. That's the first sort of piece of the difficulty of birth puzzle. And then the brain gets triples in size, you know, in the period of time from 5 million years to a couple million years ago. And then with modern nutrition, the thing, you know, you're able to feed that fetus in a way that it's never been fed before. So women can develop and grow this child that's just bigger than it's ever been. You put all that in the stew and mix it together, and you've got a problem. And I think we've reached the point in time where it's finally kind of being checked by natural selection. That's part of the explanation behind the explosion in C-section rates. And then the other part is just doctors scheduling their lives and patients scheduling their lives and everybody trying to do things on a sort of, oh, I'm going to have my child on November 15th at 10 in the morning and then do this in the afternoon, you know. And that's probably not what we should be doing. You know, that's a lot of those things need to just follow their more natural schedule. And so that's also part of the explanation.
Well, there's a whole nother avenue that you could have gone in if you had more time, which had to do with kind of metabolism and nutrition. And you mentioned just this in a very small part in that chapter about kind of diabetes during pregnancy and how this is actually a huge problem, particularly for people who are coming from kind of ancestries that did not have a lot of sugars in their background, right? So it's not just a problem when these people move to the Western world, but also they are having big changes in their diets in the countries in which they live, right? And right. So this is becoming a global problem.
Yeah, and they have bodies that sort of have evolved under conditions where they're, like you said, there wasn't historical access to a lot of carbohydrates. So their bodies have evolved in a way to kind of hoard carbohydrates when they can. And now we're just flooding the environment with sugars and carbohydrates, and it makes it so that it sets a woman up to run into trouble when she becomes pregnant, and you overload the system, and you put a fetus in there that starts to manipulate her physiology. That's a big takeaway for me from the reproductive section of the book, is to realize that this relationship between the mother and the unborn child is, there's some conflict there. They have sort of competing interests, right?
As I like to say, they're frenemies.
Yeah, that's very well put. They are frenemies. Right. That's right. So they kind of they have to look out for each other a little bit, but only to a degree. The fetus is going to push the envelope as much as it can, and take as much as it can from the mother, which really, to me, is one of the more interesting explanations behind menstruation, which is something we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah, I wanted to hear, because you talk about the fetus as like a vampire, right? Like a parasite, and the mother has to develop mechanisms to sort of protect herself from this vampire. And of course, I've heard about the placenta as a defense mechanism, right? As a protective barrier against this parasite, as a security system. But you also mentioned menstruation as a preventative tool. So how does that work?
So yeah, that was the most interesting chapter of the whole book for me to write. It was the one chapter I went into not really having any idea where the answer lay. And so the first thing I learned when working on sort of the big question of why do human females menstruate, the first thing that that I learned was that, well, most mammals don't. And I had an idea about that, but I never really got into the details of it. And it turns out, you know, 95% of mammals do not menstruate.
Well, I mean, anyone who's been around livestock, right, or even have pets in their home, you know, noticed this. And
yeah, and they...
You know, yeah. You don't have little, there's no tampons for your dog, right, or for your horse. For your dog, yeah. Right?
But it's amazing. Even when I tell it to people, a lot of people, they've seen their dog and they've seen some blood coming out and they think, oh, well, my dog does that, but it's not menstruation. Like, your dog is having some discharge related to going into heat or some other thing. It's not menstruation. And so that was kind of the first thing I had to figure out how to explain. But then I quickly got into, you can't go down to the why does menstruation happen path very far before you get into this nasty, difficult term to understand, which is called spontaneous decidualization. And for a while, I just kind of put it in my outline and tabled it. And I was like, all right, I'll figure that out later. And finally, I couldn't put it off any longer. And I got to that chapter. And what that term means is that the uterine lining changes. And that's the decidualization part. That word just means the change in the uterine lining. And in most mammals, it changes in response to pregnancy. So they do not change, they do not make giant cellular physiological changes to their uterine lining until they get pregnant. So that's the way it works in most mammals. But in humans and the other old world primates and a few random things on the tree, like there's some bats and a couple of shrews, it changes in preparation for pregnancy. It changes spontaneously. So that's the spontaneous part of the puzzle, spontaneous decidualization. And it turns out in all the animals that do that, that change it spontaneously, those are the ones that menstruate. Once that lining has changed, once you've made changes to that cellular lining, if the animal does not get pregnant, then you can't go backwards. You can't rewind those cells back to their original state, and they just have to be gotten rid of so that you can do it again the next month. You can't just keep them in that permanently decidualized state because it's all under hormonal control. The hormones change every month, and it all has to just get sloughed out. So then I realized, turns out that the question was not, why do females menstruate? The question is, why do they change that lining? Why do they undergo that process? And because that is really what drives menstruation. There's two really strong hypotheses for it, one of which is drives to this sort of, you know, fetuses as vampires idea, where the fetuses in humans just burrow in to the human female to an almost unprecedented degree. They get right in there next to her vasculature in such a way that they can then release hormones that manipulate her blood sugar and her, you know, her physiology in ways that can potentially be dangerous. And so one hypothesis is that by changing that lining before pregnancy, you can sort of build in a little bit of defense against the impending invasion by the embryo and fetus. It allows you to build a little bit of physical, mechanical defense that keeps them from burrowing as far as they would without that. And there's great evidence to suggest that whose uterine linings are unable to do that to quite the same degree, they sort of suffer from more miscarriages and more problems with their pregnancy than women whose layers decidualize as they should spontaneously. The other piece, and this is the most fascinating sort of what, why does that happen kind of thing to me, is that, so the other hypothesis is that it drives to the fact that humans make really, really error prone embryos for reasons that I've never read a good explanation for it. You bring a perfectly healthy sperm together with a perfectly healthy egg, and more times than not in a human, it makes an embryo that has chromosomal aberrancy. It's got these chromosomal issues, maybe not a whole chromosome missing here or there, but pieces of chromosome that have moved to another one. It's just chromosomally off kilter. More embryos are like that than not to start off with. And a woman whose layer has spontaneously decidualized properly is able to detect an embryo that has really, really significant problems, and it naturally aborts it. And if a woman, for uterine lining, if for whatever reason, is not able to do that, she's more likely to carry that error-prone embryo deeper into pregnancy. It's likely going to miscarry later on as it gets to sort of later stages of development. So that's the second idea, is that it helps the woman's body naturally select for the healthiest pregnancies. Fascinating stuff. I mean, it's just like this whole world, everybody's out there, you know, half the population's out there spending 40 years of their lives menstruating. Nobody talks about why. And only recently have people started to look into it. And I just think it's the most fascinating biology on earth.
And costly. And modern women do it far more than our ancestors, and also far more than these other primates and shrews and bats that menstruate, right? Because they are either pregnant more frequently or lactating more frequently, right?
You're absolutely right. And a woman now will go through, you know, hundreds of cycles in her life, whereas historically it would have been, you know, maybe 100, but not most of the time. Like you said, they were either pregnant or nursing, at which point they're not menstruating. And it's interesting you brought up the socio sort of economic piece of it, because I feel like people are just now starting to pay attention to that. It should have been something people were paying attention to forever, but I feel like I'm starting to see more headlines about colleges that are providing, you know, all feminine hygiene products to their students and those kinds of things. And that just needs to just take off worldwide. I've even seen, I forget which countries, maybe it was New Zealand. I've heard a couple headlines where countries are starting to sort of tackle the issue at the countrywide level. We're just going
to... There's a famous entrepreneur in India that has made available low-cost menstrual products, because in India, apparently, at least among the more traditional low-income folks, they don't have any products for them,
which changes everything in terms of when that time comes along, your ability to, you know, how you can go off and do the work that you need to do. If some of those things are taken care of the way that they should be, it allows women to elevate the way that they should.
Well, there's one other thing in the chapter on reproduction you mentioned, which is the sperm count, and you talk about how that seems to be in decline in modern societies. I've read that there's conflicting evidence on this, and some people talk about exposure to chemicals and so forth, but it could also just mean that it's expensive and we don't really need it, right? So if we're not engaging in sperm competition, right? So what is really driving that? What are the different theories behind that we see?
Yeah, that's an interesting. So the most things that I've read are try to pin it kind of on modern conveniences and modern, you know, the way that our food is processed and the way that all these different things that flood into our bodies. And nobody's really pinned down anything in terms of that I've seen that really gets at the answer. The correlation that has been met, like you brought up, is that sort of in the developed countries that sperm counts have been lowering. That's an interesting idea about whether or not sperm competition is taking place more in certain countries than others. I mean, if there are places where people are sort of more in traditional monogamous committed relationships, yeah, you're right. Those people, you know, sperm count is, or sperm competition is less of a factor in those kinds of environments. And we grew up, or we evolved rather, if we grew up, we evolved in an environment where sperm competition probably played a pretty significant role. And that drove this ridiculous increase in sperm count that made it so that you literally need hundreds of millions of sperm just to fertilize, you know, to successfully fertilize a single egg. And have we sort of started to head down a path where that is kind of less of an aspect of our biology anymore? And it's kind of painted us into a corner where we might not produce as many sperm as we used to because of the way we behave now. So it's one of those topics that people aren't really talking about as much as I feel like people should be talking about it, because the numbers are quite perilous. I mean, it's kind of like the climate change issue where it's clearly going on. And are we going to hit a point where it falls off a cliff? And I feel like the sperm count issue is a similar kind of issue. It's clearly declining. We don't really know why, and the climate change, we have a much better idea of why it's happening. But with the sperm count, well, we don't really even know why. And you have to wonder if we're going to reach a point where it becomes a significant societal and cultural issue. I mean, there's already so many couples that struggle with fertility that I feel like it's going to be a big issue in 21st century biology.
You know, we already are at the point where we can't survive without culture and science. And so it may well be that we lose our capacity to reproduce without, you know, medical assistance, right?
It'll be interesting to see. It'd be fascinating to have a crystal ball and jump out 100 years and see if humans are still, you know, 100,000 years, whatever, how far you have to go to see if humans are still reproducing in the historical, traditional way.
Well, one last question. You talk about, to get back to your back, you talk about sleep and the trouble you had sleeping. And did you ever build yourself a gorilla bed and try it out? And then what did your wife think of that? I mean, did you ever go out and sleep in a tree and see what it was like?
You know, I treat sleep the same way that with many of these other issues. I think mixing it up is kind of the key. So I've learned to, I've tried to keep the core strong, and I've learned to, for me, I think a big thing with sleep is no. So I haven't moved up into the treehouse yet, but what I have tried to work on in recent years is, and it's hard once you get those patterns really ingrained, is learning to sleep in different positions. So I think it's important to be able to sleep, you know, can you sleep on your back if that's the way at that moment in time that is causing you the least amount of pain? Can you sleep on both of your sides comfortably? And so it's something I actually kind of work on, is making sure that I can fall asleep in different positions, because not every position is going to work for you at every moment in time. And if you are stuck you have to sleep this way, well, as soon as that position starts to give you trouble, then your quality of sleep is going to greatly decline. And I think there's almost nothing more important in life than quality of sleep. And I mean, for me, that drives, I'm all about, you know, you got to have energy to attack your day. And so, yeah, it's a really fascinating topic.
Yeah, there's all sorts of new research on the negative impact of poor sleep. And so there's lots of things that you can take away from this book, lots of advice, even though it's not written as an advice book, there's advice buried throughout the book. There's also ideas for further research. But I think if your students learn anything from your class, they're probably learning simply to ask the question, why? And I think if they forget the name of the plantar fascia, and they forget different types of menisci that we have, that's probably fine, as long as they remember to continually ask these questions. I think that you will give them their money's worth. And I certainly think that if you go buy the book, you'll get your money's worth too. Evolution Gone Wrong. Alex, it's been a great treat. Thank you so much for joining me today.
I really appreciate having the chance to talk to you.
Thank you for tuning in to the Unsiloed Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a 5-star rating and review. To listen to other episodes, please visit our website at www.unsiloedpodcast.com.